Welcome, welcome again to Rover Talk. This is episode 5, one of the most important episodes. Now, they're all really cool. Today we're going to be discussing a lot about the Land Rover Discovery. And I know Dan, otherwise known as Wagon Boy TD on Instagram, also our beloved Bring a Trailer, is with me as usual. Dan, how are you?
Good, I'm good.
Dan's going to tell us briefly a little bit about what we just did a few hours ago, or actually about 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know where to find us. We're now on Spotify. We will be on Apple iTunes podcast, and of course on the Simplecast website. You can look for us, Rover Talk. We've done 4, and this will be our 5th episode of Rover Talk, everything from Range Rovers to owning a Land Rover to diesel versus gas. You know, we want everybody to chime in. So if you want to send us your opinion, do it to rovertalk55@gmail.com or just ask us on Instagram. Rovertalk also has its own Instagram. Dan, isn't that right?
Yes, just up and running.
So before we get into the Land Rover Discovery, Dan, what did we just do?
Well, the entire last week, we decided to refresh all my suspension because it still had the original suspension from 30 years ago, believe it or not.
And that's in Dan's 1990 two-door Range Rover Classic.
Yep, correct.
Because he's got a few Land Rovers, in case you didn't know.
So we decided to tackle that, and also including the steering box. Well, after I put in the steering box, and as you know, it's, you know, weighs like 1 million pounds. So I was surprised I actually got it lifted up back in there. But in doing so, I did not line up. There's 3 knuckles in the main steering rod, and one of the knuckles, somehow I was not able to line up, and it was driving me crazy for a few days until I reached out back to Ivan and said, you have to come over because I'm going to kill myself if I cannot get this bolt in there. And after, you know, half hour, 45 minutes of pushing and pulling and pushing and pulling, Ivan successfully slid that last bolt in.
Note to all of you Land Rover owners, a set of crowbars does wonders for many different tasks. So if you don't have them, buy them. And don't buy the ones that are metal, like the ones you would use to open a crate. Buy the ones that have handles.
Yeah, not like a nail remover thing.
Anyway, very valuable. So we wanted
to... I will say that thank God for that rubber bushing, because if we didn't have that rubber bushing to give us some play, we might still be out.
I mean, if it wasn't the fact that that was my first Range Rover, I'd probably want to hit it with the bar everywhere. But that usually happens when doing any more than complex stuff on Range Rovers. Anyway, we wanted to let you know a little bit about what we're doing each week, some of the projects that we have, and some of the stuff in case it's useful to you. Or if you want to reach out and learn from our experience, I bet you in a future episode we'll go into how we did that suspension, because there's a few little tips and tricks like the bottle jack that really speeds up the process.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's what we're working on. I have nothing to report because I haven't worked on any of my Land Rovers this week. I do, however, have...
Well, you have a few coming in from Spain.
Yes, right? I have five Land Rovers, a 109, two-door with a diesel engine, and then an 86 four-door with a diesel engine as well, and then 3 different, 2 3.5s, 1 manual, 1 automatic, and a 3.9 manual, all coming in hopefully by first or 2nd of December. And I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about those in detail. But today, this is the Land Rover Discovery. Now, Dan currently has one, so I'm going to let him start off and give us, you know, just the history and what it meant for Land Rover at the time, and then I'll kind of be a spectator here and listen to what he's got. A lot. He knows a lot.
I'll do the best I can. So, as you may or may not know, The disco actually started in 89, whereas most Americans are familiar with it starting in 94. So I usually call like the 89 to pre, you know, US release kind of like the pre-A, like the pre-wine, just because, you know, there were different engines that you could get, you know, two-door. So I kind of relate to it as really the very first series, and then when it launched in America, you know, kind of like the 1A maybe, sort of. So the reason...
No, this is interesting that you say that, and it's really important because if you own one of these 1989 to 1998 Discovery, pay attention because some parts website will call it a Gen 2. Some will call it a Gen 1, depending on where it's located at, because some people will consider Gen 1, like Dan was saying, 89 to 94.
Right,
just when you're ordering parts, they're basically all, you know, shared, most of it, but except for the facelift and the body parts and stuff like that. But just look more at the years than Gen 1 or Gen 2.
Yeah, 100%. Because there, like you said, there are some slight differences between, you know, essentially the Euro version versus, you know, what they had to add, obviously, for the Americans. So in 89, you know, was the first year. You have to remember that Land Rover really hadn't introduced a new, different looking model. Yes, they had like the 90 and the 110 were basically derivatives of like a series truck. But like the Disco really was the first new, what I call now an iconic design, which was something big for Land Rover at the time, because, you know, they were pretty complacent and just kind of doing the same old thing. And they needed a vehicle that was a little bit, you know, was going to stand out.
Something new. They needed something new.
Yeah, they needed something to kind of put a spark back into, you know, just basically a utility kind of company.
Because let's remember that the Range Rover basically, I mean, aside from the insertion of the four-door variation and then...
I mean, it was on...
They all look the same. They
exactly.
Really didn't have anything looking new, as much as we love them, but...
Yeah, I mean, it was almost 20 years, you know, because...
Yeah.
That they were riding on the coattails of the, you know, the RRC, the classic that we know. As Ivan was saying... you know, I do have a diesel 93, and that was fairly common in the Euro disco, just because of the fact that like diesel was a more viable
fuel. It was cheaper.
It was just cheaper, and that's what the European market, you know, pretty much demanded. You know, in the first gen or the Euro gen, everything was still very, very
rudimentary.
It was pared down. You know, you still had, you know, obviously no airbags. The electronics were, you know, pretty minimal. You know, mine has manual, essentially everything, windows, no sunroof. You know, it was just so built to do its job, and a little bit more capacity, obviously, in the back. Compared to, let's say, a 90, which is essentially like almost the same length.
And, of course, there was the two-door model, which I believe you could get two-door and four-door at the same time. Or am I wrong there? Was the introduction of the model just a two-door?
It was just a two-door.
Just a two-door.
So if you look at, if you look at all of that generation, it's all going to be, you know, it's all going to be two doors.
Now, the cool thing about the two doors is that there were actually 7-seater two doors where you could, you remember that green one I had?
Yeah. Which is, you know, there's two, what we would think of as, you know, an SE7 essentially.
Yeah.
You know, but with two doors, it seemed to me, I never understood the reason to want that many seats. And I know that you loved it because you had done, you know, essentially a safari, if you will, in that, and you needed that sort of seating. But for me, who's a hauler that hauls a ton of stuff, like that just doesn't, to me, you know, I always take out the second row seats just because I needed more space.
So it came out originally with, so you could get, well, Dan, what were the engines?
So you could get you could get both, a petrol. It would, I believe, would have came with the Rover V8, but they're really, really, like, I haven't seen them ever come up, and I don't think in your searches when you've been bringing discos over, mainly for the fact that you had brought over early 90s, which were either going to be the 200 or the 300. Your 94 had the 300,
yeah.
I believe, right?
Yeah. No, originally, I believe you could get a gas V8, or there might have been a gas six-cylinder available, or am I making that up? That could be.
No, that's
no.
Right.
So you could get either the V8 or what started off being the 200 TDI, the Land Rover TDI, which you could get from 1989 from the very beginning of the model year on. And then I believe it was at the end of 93, beginning of 94, that you could get the 300 TDI, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And then that was also 93, 94 was when they also started making the four-door model.
That is
well.
Correct, yeah. Because they had already known on the horizon that they were going to be expanding into North America mm-hmm. market, and obviously America doesn't buy two doors unless it's a sports car. So, you know, they had to switch, you know, the production all into four doors at that time.
Yeah.
And then obviously when they, in 94, when they knew they were coming to North America, you know, they had to put in airbags and, you know, all the usual BS that, you know, we need to have people be safe in their vehicles.
Yeah, those are always things that happen in this time. They would start off with a two door and then go into the two door more basic model with everything, and then all of a sudden, you know, you get to the U.S. market and you've got leather and you've got AC and you've got, you know, power everything and power windows and airbags and all that stuff that was mandatory.
And, you know, the two door basically always just had one. It just had the driver as a passenger because it was either a farmer, some guy who dragged horse trailers around. Like, I mean, it essentially was just to do its work. It wasn't, you know, there was no luxury about it whatsoever.
Yeah. The most options that you, so you, I believe that you could also get a very highly optioned SE model that did have leather back then, but it was very rare to see. It wasn't a very common sight.
You wouldn't see it because no one's going to buy, you know, no one's going to like add that sort of like option mm-hmm. to a truck that's filthy 95% of the time, you know, because they already knew that the Range Rover Classic had already captured that sort of luxe market. Mm-hmm. So they knew that the disco wasn't going to be like, you know.
Well, I think, yeah, I agree. And I think there had been the other thing that I found interesting, kind of reading a little bit about why the Discovery, is that they had also realized that the Range Rover had gone up market.
Oh, now, 100% up market.
Even though, I mean, you see the early 90s Range Rovers and the ones for non-US market, and they're very utilitarian. But
well, if you look at mine, it's like, I mean, quite honestly, where is the lux in this vehicle, even though
it's in that wonderful velour, Dan. I mean, what else could you want? No, but here's the thing. Here's the interesting thing is that they had seen the positioning of the Range Rover go very upmarket, and that's probably because at the time, like we're discussing, for example, if you wanted to buy a Land Rover 1985, you had a 90 or a 110, which is basically an evolved series truck,
yep.
or a Range Rover, and there was nothing. They didn't have anything in between,
like they do now.
Yeah. Like now there's 32 different models, which is fine because you cover all the market segments. But back then, and I think that's kind of what led also to the development of the Discovery and its different iterations for, you know, the different markets.
Yeah.
But it is a very cool car. So the other thing is that, believe it or not, the Discovery is a little bit longer and a little bit taller than taller you can see it, than the Range Rover. Now, I'll tell you how I know this. I know this because when I exported yours...
Yeah, but I park my Classic right next to my Disco, as you know, during the winter. And
And it is. You just have to compare it to the millimeter. It's very, very millimetrically longer. Okay. No, here's the thing. I was doing, so this is kind of a dumb story, but I was doing the export process, and for the shipping, you have to give them the exact dimensions of the car, right?
Right.
So I started looking up the dimensions on the disco, you know, just basically like Wikipedia, like length, height, width. And at the same time, I had a Range Rover. Because remember, they came with that blue Range Rover?
Yeah.
So they came together. And I kept on looking, and I had the numbers side by side because I was submitting them for space on the boat for both of them. And the disco's numbers were longer, and I was like, oh, there's got to be a mistake on Wikipedia. So I went back, and I looked at the technical inspection card of both cars, the ones that comes from the factory in Spain, and the disco is ever so slightly longer than the Range Rover. And you don't think that, because when you see them, you think, oh, the Range Rover's big.
Yeah.
But no, just a little tidbit there. But anyway.
All right.
The other thing, too, that Dan mentioned is that, as was the case with the U.S. market, too, you could get a manual gearbox. Now, you had to special order it.
You did. Yep.
But you could get that. And the vast majority of the discos that were Gen 1 for the European market and for the, you know, other markets around the world were actually manual gearboxes, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have it. I mean, I shouldn't say I wouldn't have it any other way, but for that particular model disco that I have, I wouldn't want that in an automatic.
Yeah. So the cool thing is that, you know, 1994 was the first year where you could get American spec discos. Did they have the taillights a little bit higher?
So they were, I don't know how to explain it, but yes, they are like, if you park a U.S. model versus, you know, right next to mine, your tails are going to look a little bit more elevated on the American version.
Yeah. No, that's just one of those little tidbits. And when was the facelift done?
And between what?
Between the early, you know, Gen 1 and then the American Gen. Did it already have a facelift or did that come
in?
No,
it was already, if you look at a U.S. spec versus my spec, the front is, the lights are a little bit different.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, that's kind of the history behind the disco and why it came to be and they are very cool cars. I have to admit it's probably my least favorite of the classic Land Rovers.
I mean, I didn't love it, you know, for the longest time. I think I kind of like evolved into loving the design, just kind of maybe where I was at with the classic and not, you know, loving the NOS Defenders anymore. Like, I just kind of evolved into, like, what it could give me versus, you know.
Yeah. So the Discovery is basically the Gen 1 all the way up till 1998, if I'm not mistaken. Where you have the Series 2, which is what's called the Series 2. And that was kind of another facelift on the first version of the disco.
But not drastic enough, whereas like the second half of the disco 2 is like 202, 203, 204. That's a major change within that second series as far as like the facelift goes.
Yeah.
But not much between the first and the beginning of the second.
Yeah. So it's actually kind of funny. As I was driving down here to your house where you're recording this in this room, I saw a brand new disco. And it's design-wise, it's probably my least favorite of the current Land Rover lineup. But what I thought was really cool is that it has a few little details that probably resemble the Gen 1 or that they wanted to bring closer to the Gen 1. The first one was that the offset's license plate holder, which is kind of to the left of the car as you're looking at it from behind on the rear door, which I think is kind of cool. The rear door still opens up in the same way. And the height proportion versus the width reminded me a lot of the Gen 1 disco. Now, it doesn't have the slope on the roof, which is kind of a really cool design detail that the original one had, and this one, you know, the modern one doesn't. But I looked at it, and I was at a stoplight, and I was thinking, shit, that car really looks like, you know, it's got the details. Now, do I like it? No. But I like that they put details of, like, the Gen 1.
Some of the DNA, yeah. like, still in it. And yeah. I think that's always kind of been, like, their trick, in a sense, that because they know they have diehard Land Rover fans. Now, you know, some suburban moms obviously are never going to pick up on like those details, but I do love the fact that Land Rover still thinks about its DNA with yeah. its hardcore followers.
But see, for example, it reminded me a lot more of the Gen 1 than, for example, like what I wanted to get into, which is the LR3 and the LR4.
Mm-hmm.
So why they called them LR3 and LR4 for the US market, I haven't the slightest idea.
Yeah, I haven't like gotten a definitive answer as to why. You know, maybe they were tiring of the name, you know, Discovery and keep running it, but
I don't know. But for example, if you see an LR3 or an LR4, which are basically the same car, that remind me a lot less of the original Disco than the brand new one. And
really?
And here's the thing. It also has the offset plate.
Yeah.
It has that L-shaped slope in the rear glass. It also has a slope up top. But I just find it like boxy and squarish, and it just doesn't remind me. Because if you look at a disco has kind of like rounded lines. It's square shaped, but it's got rounded edges, you know. Mm-hmm. And you look at the general, like if you sit down at the bottom corner of the bumper of the Disco and you look up, you see how it kind of rounds up to the
yep.
to the roof. It's got that. It's got like rounded outlines. And the LR3 and LR4 just, I know they tried to put that in.
It actually sounds like you actually like the Disco.
Well, it's growing on me. Yours was kind of the first one that I had more experience with because I drove it around for a little bit,
yep.
especially until I got that, you know, remember how we got there and the glass was broken? So I replaced the windshield.
Yeah.
So I drove it around a little bit. I used to drive Margaret to a school in that.
Well, she loved it.
And she absolutely loved it. And then another one came by and I drove that one around too because I needed to get it sorted out. And then the last one I had was 94, which is actually one of the first years of the soft dash. And it had the 300 TDI, which the interior I liked better the previous, but they changed it. They started the change there, but so it's kind of growing on me a little bit.
Yeah.
And the space inside is just outstanding.
Yes.
There is so much room in there. And remember when I drove you around and I told you sit in the jump seats in the back?
Yes.
I mean
it is very spacious. I don't think it'd be, you know, fantastic if there was like, you know, someone else across from me.
And the jump seats have seat belts.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And by the way, the third row seats in that Gen 1 Disco, they face each other. So they're rear facing single person seats.
Yeah.
Very comfortable if you had to ride for a long time in there in comparison to other cars that you could, you know, not in comparison to like a modern car with the third row seats.
Right.
But very cool. Anyway, LR3, once we, you know, the LR3 and the LR4 were the big first like redesign of the Disco, or the Disco 3 and Disco 4. You know, they got a lot of modern upgrades. They got, you know, big 5.0 liter petrol engine. You also had a 3.0 and a 2.7 V6 diesel engines, ZF automatic and manual transmissions. You know, it became more of a much more modern and updated car. I like the LR3 and LR4 myself. I don't know why.
They're going to be, you know, during those years, it was, you know,
I kind of want to buy one.
It was the Ford Jag, you know, combination. So a lot of people do love the threes and the fours. Really, the only, you know, there's little bit of cosmetic like the grill and a little other touches like they always do from year to year. But a lot of people love those. And they're, you know, they're still, the threes are, you know, pretty cheap. I just looked at a three the other day that was like, you know, $4,000. I mean, you can get them pretty cheap now.
The thing is, if I find one at a dealer that's in decent shape and it'll give me like a straight trade for my current daily driver BMW,
I still think should go after the 322, but that's
I know, but the problem is every time I have like a spare bit of cash, I buy something to import. I buy a classic, and I just can't help myself. I can't help myself. I have a problem. Anyway, I also I have a upcoming project with a Tudor classic that we'll talk about once it gets started, because it's a really cool thing that we're gonna do. Dan, don't say anything. I can see you coming. Don't say anything. Don't say anything. Anyway, so let's go back to the so obviously, you know, Gen 1 and Gen 2 or Gen 1 is kind of like the I think the more up and coming model and like the cooler thing, but you know, they're a little bit less known. So you just kind of have to know what you're looking for, know what to look for. So, and you know, what are the models that have most value? That's the other thing.
Well, the thing right now, what I've a lot of people have seen and can't believe, or they can believe, or they hope and glad that it's happening, but we're seeing a huge surge in the second gen in the 03-04 pricing. Like we've seen from the last 2 years where, you know, everybody's going to say, oh, you know, I can find those on Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace for like $2,000. And now we're seeing them sell for, you know, over 20 on, you know, some models. So, you know, just like any of the other Land Rover kind of market, you know, it can be explosive for a little bit. And right now we're kind of seeing the 03s and 04s, you know, get some decent returns on.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think they're up and coming in the same way that we're kind of seeing the classic, the Range Rover classic boom.
And we, and you know, as we always say, there's a huge difference between what you think you're seeing on Craigslist for 2000 and something that's coming out of, you know, California for 5,000 that we're seeing sell for, you know, 15 to 20 on certain auction sites.
So you have a two-door, and I've sold two two-doors, aside, yes, you know, aside from yours that we sourced out.
Yeah.
What do you think of the value on the two-doors?
You know, it's not for everybody. You know what I mean? Like, it's a niche. You know what I mean? Like, because not, you know, a lot of people have families. You know, I'm in a different
stage in your life.
Different stage in my life. Not that I'm like over the hill, but you know, I had my kid when I was like really young, and so he's a full grown, you know, man. So I haul stuff. I don't haul people. So for me, the reason why I love the two door is, A, it's the only one I'm going to see in Chicago. No one has a two-door
disco. Not that we know of. We would have seen it showed up somewhere.
And someone would have reached out to me on,
yeah,
because
the ones that I sold to, one went to Washington, D.C., and the other one went to Washington, D.C.
Yeah. So I like the fact that, you know, it's pretty unique. And I can get literally a piano in the back of.
Here's the thing that I do have to say for the disco, though. The two-door disco, the front seat mechanisms basically fold up into the steering wheel.
Yeah, so and instead of like the what we normally would probably see, like your
seat back, right?
The seat back normally would come forward. The mechanism is so that it. Just imagine you're like getting out of a chair and you're standing up. Your body moves forward, and as you're standing up, so it's essentially the same sort of movement.
Yeah,
is that the entire seat will move up into and basically hug the steering wheel,
therefore making access into the back seat really ample.
Oh,
and I'm
yeah.
saying this because I remember when I had yours, I had Margaret's car seat in the back. And she would just, I'd move the seat and she would hop right in.
It's a full clearance. It's not like.
Yeah, you can actually fit like an actual person in there without having to entangle yourself into. There's not much of a difference between getting into a four-door than getting into a two-door, which is a great detail, by the way.
And, of course, the rear seat folds and flips and it's kind of like a Mercedes wagon. It, you know, same thing, just flips and.
Yeah, and it's so about, and if you want to take it out permanently, it's like 8 bolts, so it's not a big deal. So very cool. So the space configuration actually inside the Disco, the Gen 1 Disco, especially the two door, is actually really good for what? Now, if you're going to try to get some seats from a four door and put them in a two door, bad idea.
Nope.
Bad idea. Not going to work. But anyway, those are just kind of little details. So here's the thing about Discos in general, in terms of when you go to look at one, especially first generation one, the number one issue.
First of all, you're never going to find one that doesn't have rust, unless it's California or West Coast.
Yeah, I'd have to say it. So the main issue that the Discos...
Or out of the country, obviously.
Yeah, out of the country. Yeah, sure. So here's the thing. Most of the sun... So the sunroofs aren't your... Like the ones that... Like there's different variations of the sunroof. Some of it you just twist up a little wheel and it kind of pops up and you can unscrew it. And the other one, I think, are electric sunroofs in the American, some of the later American.
Some of the later American ones. You still had to slide back, just like you do on modern ones, where you slide back the shade.
The shade, yeah. Anyway, sunroofs will generally tend to leak.
They 100% leak.
They leak 100% of the time. I can't joke about this anymore. Anyway, so look out for that, because leaking sunroofs are an issue with these. If you live in a rainy climate, or the car's going to sleep outside for a long time, you probably want to look for something that doesn't have a sunroof. The other main issue that a lot of these cars have is that right where your A-pillar hits the body line, there is a drain spot. And if you follow that line of the A-pillar all the way to the bottom of the car, you know, very 100% perpendicular to the ground, there is a drain spot there. That drain spot will get clogged. And the problem is that then the water goes into your rocker panels and spreads up into your floor. The reason I'm saying this is because I know firsthand what it is to find out that you have a bunch of rust in a car that you thought was rust-free. But that's a weak spot. The general drainage channels that were designed on the Disco were not sufficient for a decent amount of water. So unless you lived in the desert, you know, you got that clogged. So mainly when you're looking at these cars and when you're about to buy one, you absolutely need to get underneath and check the rocker panels. Look for signs of rust coming from the inside to the out. Side, which is the main thing that you do. The sills are going to be bad, and you're going to see spots there. It can even eat up into the rear wheel well and the front wheel well. And another real easy thing to do, and this is kind of a pain in the ass, is you got to pull the carpet to the bare metal and see what's underneath there, because usually it will have spread through there. And the last thing, very important, is if the car has floorboards on, aftermarket or Land Rover floorboards, make sure you get underneath those floorboards and check, because those floorboards help hold in a lot of the water and especially snow and sludge. And that's probably what's going to cause the rust to show up there. So those are things that not that you wouldn't do it in any other classic car, but especially here, because those spots are bad. The other really bad spot is actually the rear door has... Well, not the door itself, but where the kind of like...
Bumper and a ledge.
Yeah, the bumper meets the body. There's a plastic ledge. That's a plastic piece that's screwed on. That will hold humidity as well. So you want to... I know sometimes at a pre-purchase inspection, you can't start taking parts off of a car.
Like, excuse me, sir. Can I remove this?
I'm sorry. Can I take your car apart? Anyway... The upside of that is that there's a guy in the UK that sells the whole kit with the sills and everything, ready to go, made to measure. I think I paid like $400 for it, which I didn't think was bad at all, shipping included. And it was literally a weld-on, weld-off kit that was for repairing the sills on these cars. And yes, the rust went a little bit deeper, but I'll tell you too, if it's a really good car and that's all that you're going to need to do to it, or, you know, the one that I had was really bad and I threw about $4,000 to getting it repaired. And honestly, the rust had gone, you know, pretty bad, and it was pretty bad in a lot of spots. And I didn't have the chance to inspect this one in person in Spain. I sent somebody else, which I knew I would have seen it. But anyway, it's, you know, it's life happens that way. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. But think about it, that in the worst case scenario, you're going to throw about $4,000 at getting it repaired. But, you know, if you repair it once, you probably won't have to do it again. You just take care and pay attention to that.
Right. But I mean, that if you're, obviously, if you're into it and you're just thinking, oh, I'm going to wait for the market to change and I'm going to, you know, maybe flip it, $4,000, you know, is a huge kind of decision. So making sure that you want to buy something, like you said, that's rust free.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's better to wait than to spend $4,000. Dan, what about the Three Amigos?
Well, thankfully, I drive a Gen 1, so it's.
But this is something that happens on a.
So when you're mainly on the second half, well, basically all of the second gen, since you have so much more electronical bullshit that's going on in your car, the car is going to tell you, you know, by the dash that you have these three major things that are going on with.
So basically, if you're buying a disco and you turn the key and you turn the car on, you get three lights. It's your check engine, your ABS, and your what's the other one? That other one that's on there. Anyway, runway. It's not worth it.
I mean, but you'll have a lot of guys who that's all they deal with. You know, on a lot of forums or even on auction sites, say it's not that big of a deal. So,
well, that's kind of like anything. I mean, if you know how to fix it and you're, you know, if you've done it a few times on stuff like that, then it's always an easier thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about market values. Now, I'm going to get in here to the two-door market value segment because I think that's one of the ones that I know a little bit more about. And here's the thing. There are so few two-door discos available that it's hard to pinpoint how much you're going to pay for one.
Right.
Or how much, you know, and the other side is, available, you know, how do you get it into the United States, which if it's pre-95, you can. I'd say that two-door discos are on the up, and they're going to become even more valuable just because of the fact that people aren't thinking about them anymore as, you know, daily usable. You know, I'm going to haul my family around. However, it is a classic car in which if you have a family, it's perfect because you can haul them around. The other side of the disco too that I think adds to some of the market value is that it's very much, I would say, customizable. So there's a lot of, like, for example, in my eyes, if you put a non-standard roof rack, bigger tires, a suspension kit, and maybe a towing bumper or aftermarket bumper onto a Range Rover, you ruin it. And I don't think the same way about the disco.
No,
I think it looks so much better.
Yeah.
What have you done to yours?
So the only thing I've done to mine essentially are I put different tires. I didn't do a lift because I have to park it in my garage. But I also changed out the original rims to just steel wolves. Very clean, very, you know, very simple. A little bit of aggression with the BFs. And then I did kind of a pseudo custom rack job because I didn't want to buy safety device rack for $1,200 for a vehicle that, like, I didn't think warranted that sort of investment in it. And I kind of wanted to be a little creative with the front of the rack. So I kind of customized two racks together.
Which look really cool. The look of yours is great. And also, if you have a disco, buy the spare tire cover that has the elephant on it. Because yeah. It looks outstanding.
Well, they, you know, they give you six different animal options. And unfortunately, the original spare cover, those that have this Gen 1, know that plastic cover is pretty much next to impossible to find. That's not broken, cracked, or
yes.
you know, chip. So it's just a good remedy. Yes, yeah. It looks cool.
So the other thing too is, you know, like Dan's truck actually looks great. I think the wheel and tire combination really bring.
And it took a long time to like really figure out what I thought looked best on there.
And
because there's too many options in the world.
And then
know?
And then why did you put that diff cover on?
Because I like.
So let me give you a little background here, Dan.
I like.
Dan has a very beautiful. What's the color? Blue.
It's Ionian.
Ionian blue.
Yes.
With the blue cloth interior.
Yep. It's blue on blue on blue, essentially.
Yeah, blue on blue on blue, essentially. And the wheels that he put on are black, which
black on black.
Outstanding, because they also it's matched up with the same shade of black on the rack, custom
this
rack.
Rack
done.
And then the trim is black and, on the truck.
And the trim is black. And all of a sudden
you can obviously see it on Instagram. But yeah,
the other day Dana came to see one of the other disco, a white disco that I had in the garage. And we went to, where did we go, like Walgreens or something like that?
We had to go to Walgreens to get something or go to the bathroom or something.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, as I'm walking out of Walgreens.
No, you said.
Where did I see that? Did I see it parked outside the garage?
No, it was in the parking lot of Walgreens. And you're like, what the F is that? And I'm like, I like a little color in my life. I have this bright yellow diff cover on my rear.
A yellow diff cover on the rear. Now, for all of you that are out there, a blue on blue on blue with
black
accents. Black. Why? Why are we?
Because
why?
Because. Why? Just because I could. I did. I had one in my back supply.
I'm taking that off.
No, you're not.
I'm taking that off.
No.
Or I'm going to get underneath it and paint it.
And the funny thing is, it's, you know, I would have thought being a Land Rover that I would already have, like, you know, seepage or, you know, whatever coming out of the rear diff.
And there was nothing there?
No, it's fine.
Great.
I checked the diff. It's fine.
Anyway, that's just a detail that needs to be taken care of. But Dan's car looks absolutely great. It is a cool car, and fortunately it runs fantastic. So the other thing I want to get into here is that since most of the Gen 1s and the early ones are diesel engines, we go back to the gas versus diesel conundrum and the two different diesel engines that were available through the model years. And it was the 200 TDI, which, of course, has a reputation of being slow, which it is. And it has a reputation of being a little bit louder than the 300 TDI,
That's
right?
That's only because there's no sound cover, supposedly, and that the engine mounts were moved a little bit forward and a little better mounts.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get that, like, vibration, but I love the vibration.
And then the 300 TDI,
yeah.
Which is a little bit more powerful, same
it's
displacement.
It's the same horsepower.
It has an oil cooler too, I believe, right?
Yep.
Both of them turbo diesel. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion back and forth, but Dan, yours is a 200 TDI, and during the spring, summer months.
From April 1st to basically the first snowfall, it's going to be in like the 70s next week, so it won't be next week. But I drive it, you know, every day in Chicago, you know, every day. And I don't have like, you know, people often ask me like, don't you get annoyed that like it's a diesel, it's a manual. And I'm like, you know, I live in Chicago. Like, where am I going anywhere fast, you know? So to me, and then when I go out to the country, it serves its purpose, you know, probably more so out there because, you know, I can go off-road and, you know, do whatever I want to do with it. I can tow with it. Like, it has its purpose for me.
Yeah. By the way, it has a towing capacity of 7... If you're using a hitch with brakes, it's 3,500 kilograms.
Yeah.
On the technical inspection card. Anyway, I mean, I think it's totally, I think, you know, discos and well, you can basically daily drive anything. It just depends on your level of tolerance. But I think with the disco, same as the Range Rover Classic, they're very usable daily driver cars just because they perform what you need them to perform. Now, if you're looking for, you know, to get on the highway really quickly, you're not going to use one of these.
Right. If you're merging from, you know, onto the Dan Ryan from 51st, I mean, you're...
But it's not that bad, actually, you know? I've taken all three of them on the highway, and I didn't think they were that bad.
I've never felt that I was, like, in any sort of, like, danger. I mean, you have to remember, too, I also have a classic diesel Benz. So, I mean, I have many comparisons with, like, you know, diesels and petrols, and I've never, ever felt like... I wasn't going to be able to, like, merge at 65 miles an hour. So.
Yeah. So totally a daily drivable car, and very cool.
And you have to remember, too, it's like not everybody, including myself, buys a vehicle solely for its function.
I mean,
it makes you feel good. You love the look of it. Like, it captures something. So, I mean, it's understandable that, like, you know,
The other thing that also works amazing in discos is the air conditioning.
Oh my god! I have it, like we said, I have a 200. You would think that, like, the air conditioning in that thing would be like a little bird, like, blowing in your ear or something. But it, like, I freeze out. I don't know what they did, because it, you know, it didn't come with air conditioning. It was added probably at some point. But it was put behind what was, like, what we would think the glove box, and oh my god, it's freezing. And I'm not, like, an air conditioning guy, so I could care less, but it is a nice feature, because, you know, it can get up to, you know, 100 in Chicago, and if I needed it, it would be great.
Yeah.
And I know you've had air in your other discos, no?
And it, I mean, except for I had it repaired in one because I knew it didn't work.
Yeah.
And so I had a new compressor put in, new evaporator.
Just so that people know, like, you know, that's like the first question on any auction site is, like, does it have air? Because they're worried about the cost. How much was it to, like, take care of that?
It was $800.
Okay.
And it was converted to R134A because these the ones from the Euro market pre 95, I think it is, or 94, were still R12s.
Yeah, they're on the 12s.
So it's not bad. And you know, honestly, it works amazing. I mean, you can get, I've driven.
And for $800, you're going to get a return on that when you go to sell it. Like, to me, it's a no brainer because everybody, for some reason, has to have
air conditioning. Yeah.
Whether they actually are going to use it or not, like, it's like that same old myth, like, at 100,000, your car is going to die. If you don't have air, you're not going to be able to sell it.
I think people, when they comment on auction sites about that, they should mandatorily have to say where they live. Because, yes, if you live in Tucson, Arizona.
Or Florida, swampy Florida.
You need air conditioning, yes.
New Orleans, yes.
Because if not, you might die. But if you're from the north and you're asking about air conditioning, no. Bad thing. Anyway. Very cool car. So, you know, take a look at Dan has a bunch of pictures of his on Instagram. It's Wagon Boy TD. My Instagram is SRI2405. I need to change that. But anyway, SRI2405. I've got pictures of the discos that I've had too, which are pretty cool.
Well, actually, on Rover Talk Instagram, I put ours face to face, your green one that you had, and my Ionian.
Oh, uh-huh, that's a cool one.
Yeah,
that green one actually was a very highly spec'd one because it had had electric windows, air conditioning from the factory, and the third row jump seats, and the dual sunroofs.
I mean, it pretty much is icon, like, layout, like the color. Everything is, when you think disco, like, that's kind of probably what people think of.
Yeah.
You know, immediately.
Very, very cool car. Anyway, so we're going to be back next week. We've got a few different topics, and you know what? I haven't decided what we're going to talk about next week, but please reach out to us at rovertalk55@gmail.com.
If you want us to talk about something, we'll talk about it.
We will. And we will address every, like, if you know more than we do, which can be likely, or if you have, you know, if you don't like what we're saying about certain cars, please share it with us. We're open to anything and anyone, and we'll actually address a lot of that stuff that comes in on these podcasts so that we can, you know,
be corrected.
Be corrected. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you know, we might bring in some guests sooner than later. Anyway, thank you for listening to us, Dan. Thank you so much.
Of course.
What did they call you? A walking Land Rover manual the other day?
I don't know.
Thank you for listening to us. You know where to find us. Simplecast, also on Spotify. This will be, you know, we'll try to upload once a week if our schedule allows for it. And enjoy your Land Rovers as much as possible before the winter gets upon us.
All right, guys.
Take care.